member of the Unacceptables. My mind is malignant.
Today, I open up my book for all to see. The words I speak are mine alone today.
Yes.
No offenses, no pretenses, just poetry.
Welcome to Griot Silenci. If you think that modern science was a white man's invention that was put together in a rusty lab and slapped upon a label, then think again. If modern science is white, it is only because of the symphony of lights, intellect radiating from the darkest corners of this world, the marriage of ideas consummated to produce wonders, and the house became an inevitable necessity, a structure to practice methodologies in safety and validity. Now, that house, its proud walls, is now marked with bold words of a shameful segregation saying, "Science only here." Etched in every bathroom door is, "No non-scientist allowed," as if it is only the scientist's kidneys that are capable of producing urine. This house harbors a wealth of personalities who swell like glass bottles of Coca-Cola behind freezer doors. You see, once you're inside, feelings cannot be uttered. You are distinguished only by name. Your sole purpose is to receive citations. Perhaps if you get a Nobel Prize, your opinions might be taken seriously. We in this house wear uniform coats, fantasizing forbidden thoughts, yearning but insecurities inhibiting. We have become arrogant, rich children, ignorant of our roots, sending off gadgets into a third world where plugs don't quite fit the outlets. We in this house have become like elders clustered in tight spaces, shielding ourselves behind scabs formed from old cuts that run too deep for too long, so that when it came time to let go of tough calluses for permeable skin, we clung on, refusing even the softest touch of the air that allowed us healing. Losing memory of the curious child that dared to be vulnerable, leaving grandchildren wondering why they aren't allowed to just play as they carefully tread corridors of that rusty old house that denies the rainbows that once danced on its walls.
So I am here with Joseph Felton, but apart from the ethics of science, looking back into these, gaps where other disciplines can permeate science, is the use of art as a research method.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you've witnessed, we've been working on a project with carbon nanotubes that was sparked by my interest in something as simple as the fact that their appearance is similar to hair.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that, it struck me not only because I am a woman and a woman of color who has, experienced a lot of research with my own hair, as many women with difficult hair have experienced. But there is definitely a lot of investigation, that is not thought of as scientific investigation that goes on in the realm of hair. But aside from that, hair is, very interesting. They come in different categories, different curls. They're like a massive springs on the head or massive strings, and they behave in a very interesting, chaotic environment, which is similar to the entanglement that exists in carbon nanotubes. So it's interesting because speaking to one of the other scientists we work with, Patty Martinez, on carbon nanotubes, she made a similar observation, But according to her, as a scientist, she felt it was inappropriate. Like, how am I going to write about hair on, you know, this publication?
One point, like, say, early on, how you talked about, like kind of a throwaway line was that hair is not a scientific, you know, thing or a scientific investigation. That's totally a cultural value. There's no reason why one could not have a scientific study of hair types, you know, how they react, how you can manipulate them, and so on and so forth. It's just that we don't, and there's just informal, I call it informal research.
Mm-hmm.
Without, you know, a whole lot of formalized research.
I've seen some.
Before, you know, how one finds a good hairstylist for good hair for somebody who's good for, like, you know, type 4 hair, type 3 hair, type 2 hair, to keep it tamed under frizz. And it's all, I mean, there's, you know, companies that sell you the right hair products, quote unquote, but are they truly that great at it? And, you know, what is the degree that they, you know, make it more manageable or make it more whatever you want to do with it? There's just no research behind it, but there's no reason why there shouldn't be, besides people not saying that it's, you know, good and proper for funding this research.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why that is so. I mean, I can go into navel gazing real fast, but it is cultural, I think, to say hair is not a good thing for, you know, for serious scientific research. And there's no reason why that is not a positive statement that has any basis in reality, or any base, not in reality. It is a thing that you can step out back and say, yes, it's true. There is no university with Institute of Hair Science Studies. Sure, fine. Okay.
would be interesting.
Yeah, you giggle at that, but that is a culturally programmed reflex that there is no one out there that is making a strong, systematic study of people's hair.
Oh, yes.
It's just all informal and, you know, like word of mouth of how to treat this stuff or that stuff or internet searches or what have you.
And, yeah, I have seen a few papers on hair, and they are becoming more and more. Well, there was one on the behavior of different hair types on application of heat.
Yeah.
Which was solely produced to help hair salonists.
Yeah, but it's very ad hoc here and there.
Better hair treatment, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, it's totally legit. It's totally something that should be viewed as legitimate in science, because you can have a question, you can have a hypothesis, and you can have a way to test that hypothesis.
The point is that different perspectives of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Or different disciplines that have kind of different ideas of what it means to be successful, or mm-hmm. what it means to, you know, be valid. Or valid is not the right word.
Valuable, maybe?
Valuable. What it means to be valuable could lead to really just unanticipated areas of exploration in science,
mm-hmm.
things that perhaps we haven't even thought about because we haven't been to that point of thinking about it.
There's a truism in science that it takes, you know, two generations to figure out what stuff is quote-unquote useful for day-to-day life and what isn't. For most research, it takes at least one generation to get it from the lab to the production facility. So, and what influences the next thing is always going to be an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you go from, you know, general relativity, be like, yeah, sure, whatever, motion of the stars. But, you know, nowadays, that's actually really important for GPS precision.
Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the case.
No, that wasn't the case back in the day. No one was going to be like, you know what, I'm totally expecting everyone to be able to move at quarter the speed of light. Or I have to worry about things in the gravity well versus things not within the gravity well and up and down the well. No, there's none of that. Like, fundamental scientific research generally is so far out there, you can't point to, like, an application. So people saying, you know, what is valid for science or what is not valid for science has struck me as kind of odd because it's not something you can point to and say what will be useful. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about hair already and the entanglements and, you know, types of hair. What happens if you can have, like, a mesoscopic structure for keratin that you can have for sustainable, like, wires that are just as strong as steel? It could be grown out of, like, you know, spider silk or something along those lines. Suddenly it's... I mean, this is pure science fiction speculation. There's no knowledge I have of here.
And going on the idea of science fiction as a tool, and in fact as an art tool.
Oh, are we going to go to Gene Roddenberry? Can we talk about cell phones?
I have no idea who Gene Roddenberry is.
Oh, uh-oh. Well, welcome to 1950s white people story time. So Star Trek was kind of a big inspiration for most, like, nerds out there in the U.S. You will you can probably point them and be like, yeah, I thought the tricorder was cool. I thought, you know, this, that, or the other, the handheld scanner that the doctor used on his patients, blah, 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 blah. A lot of that's like inspiration for things like the cell phone. Mm-hmm. The inventors of the cell phone, the guy at Motorola, was like, man, I love watching Star Trek as a kid and their little handheld, like, radios that connect to everyone and everywhere. And cell phones were the thing, were my answer for that.
That's amazing.
Right? You can directly point to, like, the one of the biggest cultural things of the last 2 decades.
You have these subconscious seeds that are planted into young children who grow up to be scientists. And these seeds grow, you know, though we may not realize them. They grow and they sprout into the work that we do.
Suddenly I'm interested in watching what's going on at YouTube that four-year-olds watch. I'm not sure if I'm afraid or hopeful.
I'm sure it will be very, very exciting. We probably won't get it.
I am suddenly curious of what, like, a profile of a prototypical child watching YouTube looks like for their YouTube videos.
Yeah. But one other thing that we've been doing as an art science research lab is this the use of poetry,
mm-hmm.
and in this case, spoken word. So what you had at the beginning of this podcast was a spoken word poem that was actually inspired by, you know, the culture of science, but also by carbon nanotubes and their entanglement and how they, you know, they sometimes get drawn out smoothly. But my point is that poetry and spoken word poetry in this particular case, because it is more engaging and more participatory, kind of creates these vivid metaphors. You know, they put images together, you know, images, unpredictable images are juxtaposed upon each other, and through that we create metaphors to represent something, a concept, an idea. Yeah. For me, this process of creating metaphors, which is also a part of the model for learning, for how the brain learns things, is kind of is a strong spark to engaging the creativity of any individual. It's like the sci-fi, looking at your work through the lens of science fiction, but it's has some truth in it. And thus, I believe that using spoken word poetry as a tool for scientific research and investigation, as well as for, you know, communication and exchange of scientific concepts or issues that affect society, would be powerful.
Yeah, like, there isn't, certainly for talking to society itself, we talk about, you mentioned, like, poetry as a method for communication, and it reminds you of a saying about if truth pointed to itself, there would be no need for eloquence, which I don't remember where that quote came from or who said it, but I'm absolutely certain I'm quoting somebody, probably
if
because
truth pointed to itself,
there would be no need, yeah. I don't know where that's from. I remember reading a Bartlett's Book of Quotations when I was in detention as a junior high student, mm-hmm. But
modern communication, you know, because...
a new perspective to try out, to look at the data. Exactly. A new perspective to think of experimental design.
Exactly.
A new perspective for, you know, just saying, is this possible? Or can we dream about this?
It's a way of engaging, you know, the mm-hmm. person, not just passively listening to information that, you know, the big guys out there pass down. It's a way to, you know, engage in that, and also just... You know, the whole idea of imagination, obviously imagination is different for a scientist, for an artist, for a poet. But I think that the mind working outside of a box or outside of container is enough to spark imagination in any discipline, including that of a scientist.
Certainly, it's a way to just keep your eyes open. Like, I guess I have a story of a paper I actually wrote that would not have been meaningful if I only looked at the data that my computer was spitting out at me, mm-hmm. was that, you know, I had a dye-sensitized solar cell, which, quick story, it has, like, as part of its operation, an iodine-colored liquid to mediate a chemical reaction that goes on in it. Over and over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a slightly yellowish-reddish tinge that with the addition of a certain material that we used for another part of that solar cell, we actually were able to turn that electrolyte, that liquid, clear for transient amounts of time. Like when the sun, when our simulated sunlight went onto it, the liquid went clear, and then when we took it out, it went unclear. Now, it didn't have major effects upon, you know, the workings of the solar cell itself, nothing you could see that was reflected in purely the data that spat out for the IV curves of that solar cell photovoltaic test cell. But when you look at it, you just saw the colors change of that electrolyte, and eventually that led to the understanding that we were actually introducing, some of the materials that we had were actually breaking apart and becoming like quantum dots in that liquid medium. Mm-hmm. And with that, we had a wholly new paper that was pretty dang unique.
And that was not evidence just by the data.
It was by just looking at it, by just keeping your eyes open, just by the color change mm-hmm. of it all. And it's... there's certainly a very valid point of not just looking narrowly at like this one set of data or at this one thing, one factor that you're trying to optimize. Mm-hmm. Is that why you're trying to optimize it? Something else might happen serendipitously. And mm-hmm. unless you're prepared for it.
Or unless you have an artist by your side.
Unless you have somebody thinking about it or looking for it, not just directly down the lines, paint by numbers research. Then you'll miss that stuff. And it was a really neat paper. It wasn't like widely cited, but it's probably still one of my favorite like research papers I have done. Uh-huh. Like it's just been like one of those things that I would never have had that research paper if I just, you know, turned it on, let the system run and walk away. Uh-huh. Right? You just got to engage with the work that you're doing more so than just, you know, feeding the machine and go, you know. Uh-huh. Or we have these variables. We need to. We have these variables. We have these material. We have these tools. We must optimize for X or Y.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about your other methods. That was a brilliant example. But personally, for me, especially as an undergrad student or doing research, sometimes writing things in the correct format, in academic writing. Would sort of limit my mind, mm-hmm. or I wouldn't be as, you know, mentally flexible. And so I would start writing what I was learning or what I was investigating in poetry or prose form, mm-hmm. kind of like a conversation with myself or something, or like a little comic strip.
Yeah.
Do you have any similar experiences in like a different way that you approached your research?
Usually for, I guess, my own understanding, I also, like I suspect most people, rely heavily on analogies of like, you know, everyday objects, mm-hmm. or, you know, even for, like, you know, talking about electricity, it's the flow, kind of like water, mm-hmm. you know, the voltage potential is, you know, the angle and the height difference and this, that, and the other, right? Mm-hmm. And the amount of water that flows is the current. Mm-hmm. So for, like, you talk about academic writing, and I'd like to point this out, is that it's mostly in English, and that's kind of by social convention and the fact that the last two empires, or the last empire and the current empire, are both English-speaking empires. And the fact that English is not the primary language of what I suspect is the vast, vast majority of scientists out there. So you have kind of an agreed-upon prose style that everyone can more or less understand reasonably well. And that is, unfortunately, a limitation of necessity for communicating clearly to each other. But it does, like, kind of shove you through a little hole for your own personal understanding. And, you know, if you're only relying upon, like, reading those academic articles and rather than doing the research and trying to understand it like a narrative format, mm-hmm. like you've mentioned before. So I agree that there is definitely limitations, and if you talk about academic writing. However, I do feel like that it's important to say that there's a reason why those things are there in the first place.
Of course. Of course. I mean, they were established for a reason. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
but like know. I like to say, they're not laws.
No, those are not, well, the only laws on wherever Newton's, and even then, those are conditional.
Even then. So, who knows what kind of science we'll have in 50 years, right?
not sure. Probably a lot of it will be focused on biological sciences stuff. I mean, that seems to be the the thing that culturally a lot of people are, you know, leaning into.
And it's also interesting that you pointed out analogies, because, you know, everything we do in science is a model of how we understand reality. It's not... This is a very philosophical question. It is a model. Everything is a model. Yeah. Mathematics.
All is a model. Science is conditional.
Diagrams is a model. Yeah.
And every last bit of it.
Part of the spoken word science agenda is to model science with poetry. So things that, you know, we have instruments that are just far beyond human. You know, capacity to relate. You, we can't feel these things. We can't see them, smell them. You know, so
yeah, nobody smells.
But we still
radiation.
Need to explain them. You know, so how would one explain them? What kind of models do we create? What kind of models would a poet be better equipped to create to describe things, even define things, name them? You know. But also analogies. There's a book by Mary Hess, Models and Analogies, that talks about positive, negative, and neutral analogies. So positive being those that agree, obviously, like the flow of river, the flow of current.
Mm-hmm.
Negative, those that we know are not true. I mean, H2O is not the same thing that flows in your circuit, but the electrons are.
mm-hmm.
And then the neutral analogies, yeah, things that we are not sure yet, yeah, and that poses a lot of possibility for investigation, or it poses a gap for investigation.
And does the positive and neutral and negative analogies perhaps interfere with what we do investigate or what we do prioritize for
that
understanding?
That does, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Because at the end of the day, we're limited by bias. We're limited by the way our mind understands things. And that's why, you know, I think the more perspectives in research, in scientific research, then the better off we are.
Oh my God, agriculture is probably my favorite example of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Farming. A lot of the like green revolution for like Norman Borlaug, stuff like that, where we increased crop yields by these huge amounts and made it more amenable to mechanization, all that stuff, was the translation of basically Northern European farming methods into things that you can mechanize easily. It's not always the best way, I suspect, to mechanize other traditional farming things, and the one I like thinking about is aquaculture, Now, to grow a bunch of fish, like freshwater fish in close proximity, you gotta make sure that the water is oxygenated, right? And nominally, we do this by aerating the water, by basically making artificial fountains so you can have all the fish nearby, and then you just throw in the fish food and they grow from there. One of the things I remember reading was, I forget which culture it was, but on the Yucatan Peninsula pre-Columbian times, they had like these artificial islands that you had basically like a, like not a biosphere, what's the word? Like a little planned ecology where most everything was edible by people. And then you kind of let it go and then poked around and weeded it every now and then. And I wonder how one could figure out how to mechanize that process and not have to worry about having it, you know, a continuous influx of electricity to run the fountain for aeration or stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know if aquaponics, like intensive aquaponics, has been, that you can mechanize and automate for a lot, large amount of it, so you cut down on labor, you know, people's time, energy, and effort, which is one of the more important things for, you know, I think for leisure time in life and all the other fun stuff in the world, is like, how do you automate this? And always having that same perspective of, you know, the Norman Borlaugs of the world who grew up in, you know, the European mm-hmm. tradition of how you do farming. Mm-hmm. Why do we not have the descendants of Nahua being, you know, plant biologists or plant botanists, and wondering how that would change things or how that would work for integration of the other cultural traditions of how one does farming into, you know, automating a lot of it or mechanizing a lot of it is something that I would find really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't know where to look or ask, or maybe it's already being done and I'm just some guy talking about something not in his field whatsoever.
So if you're listening to this and you have input, then
I would certainly be happy to hear that. Yeah. Like, farming is always something I found kind of fascinating mm-hmm. at a distance. I do a little bit of gardening on my own, but I would not want to be a farmer, so to speak.
It's a hard life.
Yeah.
Again, because our culture has made it a hard life.
I don't know about that one.
To end this podcast, there's a quote by Albert Einstein, and yes, he's important, a scientist enough that his quotes are relevant, right? But it says, and I've been trying to understand what he meant exactly by this, but it says, knowledge is limited, imagination encircles the world. What do you understand by this?
For me as a scientist, I feel like, there's never any ability for someone to know everything, even about one single topic. And to generate new knowledge is never just an extension upon old knowledge. Sometimes it is a new perspective that overturns older understandings. Mm-hmm. And this, like, is encapsulated in, like, the new models I talked about with like science and scientific research. Once upon a time, we had a model of understanding chemistry that involved some kind of etheric magical fluid called phlogiston that was a substance that could be burned, and mm-hmm. now we actually know what oxidation is, right? Mm-hmm. However, that phlogiston thing, if I'm pronouncing that word right, did a pretty good job of explaining what people saw. Mm-hmm. It just is at odds with our current understanding. But you had to imagine something different than what was around mm-hmm. before you could come up with something better. Mm-hmm. Of a better understanding to, you know, explain all. You need some kind of imagination to explain that knowledge, to contextualize it. That's kind of how that quote hits me.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for your time, Joseph.
All right, thank you for having me.